Hey, 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 everyone. We're back. This is Sports Shrinks, and I am Tiffany, and with my co-host,
Katie.
and we're so happy that you all are here. Gosh, it's really, we've made it to like, I think this is what, episode six? Can we just pause for a second and acknowledge that we've done this quite a few times now? Yeah, we're ready to sign the professional documents, get us a show syndicated. We were terrified, yet we knew we would just jump in the very beginning. And it is just kind of nice to sit back and go, we've had to figure it out and it's gone pretty well.
Totally. Yep. And it's been really fun. It's fun to field the questions. It's fun to get our brains stretched and thinking and solidifying how would we address these scenarios and situations?
Well, and I think too, what you and I've said so often is how the questions are a dime a dozen. I mean, we're in these conversations all the time, and we should be, not just us, but our listeners too. And, you know, the hope is that folks are really sorting through it. And sometimes there's a very clear right answer, and sometimes it's really nuanced. And I think that's what we got to be able to do, and all in the name of helping athletes, of course. Before we get into the stuff, how have you been, Katie? How's your last couple weeks gone?
It's been good. I mean, I feel like my typical answer is like, we're in kid mode, right? A neighbor popped out yesterday, I was like, wow, you all just like go. And we're like, we just like try to keep up with our kids. And so over the weekend, Camden, actually, this is funny. I thought of you all numerous times. Camden had a baseball tournament out of town, Portland, a couple hours, 3 hours away. We were driving there. He had packed his bag. We're really big on like, you pack your stuff. You're responsible for your stuff. He packs his bag. I do the double check Saturday morning before we're about ready to leave. We get in the car. Everybody's psyched. I've been like holding on to this book I've been excited to read, and youth road trips are like, for youth sports, is always a good opportunity to catch up on some reading. So I was reading in the car. We're about probably halfway, no, closer than that, closer to where we're going. All of a sudden, I'm like, oh my gosh, we forgot your cleats. And oh, no. I look back at Camden and he's like pretty calm. And we're just like, we forgot him. Oh my gosh, we don't have him. I start to get like a little bit more riled. Adam is like immediately like, well, he forgot him. We're not getting him. And I was like, no, 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 hold on. What? Like, no, like he had packed it. I double checked it. Like, that's not a choice. He just can't like, no, isn't like the, like, we can't just say no. And I look at my phone, there's a Dick's like 3 minutes away, right? So it's like, we have an opportunity potentially to get him new cleats as his sit in our garage, or this is a natural consequence of like, we need to learn to remember our gear and check of all of our gear. So Adam and I get into this like butting of heads, like fast and furious, right? Because we have to make this decision on a dime. And Camden's never forgotten anything before. So I was like, hey, if this happened all the time, like that'd be one thing. This is the first time it's ever happened. And Adam's like, hard no, this isn't happening. This is how he learns the lesson. And we end up going back and forth very quickly. Camden remains like very calm and is like, I could wear my tennis shoes. I would like to get new cleats. Anyways, we do a quick 90 degree turn and turn into the Dick's parking lot and walk out with a new pair of cleats. And Adam and I got a lot of laughs after. It was a good moment. We pause when we get back into the car, have a family like decompress of like, hey, here's the deal. Like, we're going to get into it sometimes. We're going to have different opinions sometimes. We're going to compromise. We're going to work together. We're going to make sure that everybody is heard and that we come to the conclusion that feels best for our family unit. Anyways, it was like kind of hysterical in the sense of like, it sums up athletics in a nutshell, right? Of like this like urgency, all of the things that are happening behind the scenes before you even show up at the field or venue or arena or whatever. So parents, shout out to you all. It is a never-ending hustle with these crossroad moments that none of us really know what the right answer is, but you just have to shoot from the hip. Anyways, so that made me chuckle, still makes me chuckle.
That's incredible.
Oh, fantastic. How are you?
Really quick though, I'm just imagining the two of you, knowing the two of you in the car. And again, like it's a time limited moment. If you have an audience and you're trying to decide what to do in that moment, and just the heat is on, like you got to make a decision, and it's not like you're not in town. So, you know, you can't run home and get it. There's a decision that has to be made. Oh, how sweet.
It was comical. It is. And I'm sure relatable to you all.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I know we write about that in the book too, about, you know, the things that happen that nobody really ever sees. And mm-hmm. that is definitely in that category for sure. I'm good. It's heating up here in the Valley, and, you know, the tale is old as time as an Oregonian that, you know, if you live here, you know what it's like. As soon as the sun starts to come out and comes out with a little bit more regularity, we start to feel like things are going to be okay. And like, we did it, we got through the rainy season again. So it is really nice. And this last weekend, although I didn't get to see it in person, my niece had a huge PR with Discus. She's been on this incredible journey of learning. She really thought that shot put was going to be her sport, and she's just completely fell in love with her capacity to do discus. And
I bet you've been the split vote, the high breaker though, in terms of like, no, ultimately, are we going to get the cleats or not get the cleats? I feel like you could have been the...
The tiebreaker would be, absolutely, we're going to make a stop and we're going to get the cleats. And to any parent's dismay, we're going to have fun buying the ones that you typically wouldn't buy, because I'm buying them in the aunt role, and we're going to go have some fun and get you, whether they're the more flashy ones or more expensive ones or something. So, but again, that's what I get to do, which is just a blast. So yeah, cheers to all the kids living it up, with their aunts and parents and uncles and all the things. We had a great conversation today. And I, as we transition into our par for the course, as a reminder to everybody, we do this to kind of talk about something happening in the news. Katie and I decided to do something a little bit different, where I'm going to share with her some piece of the news versus what we had been doing before. You know, we'd find something, we'd banter about it offline, and then we'd bring it into the show. She doesn't know what I'm about ready to tell her. And we did this a little bit intentional to try it. We may hate it, actually. So who knows? We may go back. But we're experimenting, and really intentionally to have a more authentic conversation versus it feeling like we've already had the conversation. So with that said, I'm going to share with you this bit of news, and then we'll talk about it for a few minutes. And so this is about a story that is, I think it's made major national news, but it is regarding a cross-country team and a teacher and coach on a cross-country team. And at this point, at this particular school, an alum has come forward detailing the grooming and sexual misconduct by this former teacher, and that this was part of what was going on as students in the small prep school, and this was their teacher and also their coach, and would go on, you know, they would travel with this coach, as one can imagine when you're going on cross-country trips. And the grooming happened at both the level of at school and outside of school, and then carried on intense relationships with these girls over time. There was a disclosure at some point to someone at the school. And if you read the story, it talks about how the school basically ignored the disclosure, and someone at the school, I think it was another teacher, had said something like, well, when you're one of his girls, there's always going to be a brunette that he's after.
Oh.
So there's, it's kind of a developing story in terms of how many young women are coming forward. And you know, the story really being about this teacher utilizing this platform. And why I thought it made sense to bring forward here is, well, as one can imagine, you and I have been on the receiving end of a lot of these types of disclosures. And it's not news to us that this happens. However, I think it's news to people that these types of relationships occur. So I just wanted to bring it forward and kind of name it here, and really to honor these incredibly brave, courageous young women who are not holding back and really sharing what happened while they are in like 9th through 12th grade.
That's gutting. And I am with you of like, we've heard too many of these stories. And I think one of the things that is the par for the course in this is even when one of the gals somehow found it within themselves to share their experience, they were dismissed and told, well, if you're one of his girls, like that doesn't raise a red flag to anybody. Like, it is gutting. I mean, I'll be honest, like, I feel deflated. I feel like, oh my gosh, like you think my brain at least is going to this place of like, now this is their life work, right? This human, this man who was put in this position of power to be their teacher, be their coach. He abused that power. He is abusing them. And now these gals are the ones left to heal and repair and reconcile for the rest of their lives.
And I think the challenge that I think a lot of people have in understanding the dynamic of what you just said, that this is a lifelong journey now. And that's not prescribed in the sense of a therapist says, now this will be an issue for the rest of your life. That is what we know happens. That is trauma within the body, healing and recovering. And especially in this case, they didn't have a model of what it looks like for someone to be abusive in this way. The model that they had in this case was, as the article writes it, he was a god, quote unquote, is what people talked about on this campus. He was known and seen as this go-to teacher, both for his prowess as a coach, but also his capacity to really be in it with the students on campus, you know, a young guy who's come into this job, and yet time and again had at least one of these young girls on the hook until they graduated. And then there was another, and then there was another. That's how the story unfolded, where he was absolutely grooming them and into molding it into a sexual relationship for his benefit. That was an intensive relationship. And thinking about the capacity of young girls and how this intersects with sport, this is not just going and telling on a teacher, which in and of itself is, like you said, like it's so deflating, and there's so many responses to that. When I think about the lane that we're in to talk about sports, is how many young women have had to endure that mistreatment, that abuse, that trauma, that exploitation, so that they can keep doing the sport that they love. And as many would argue, the thing that actually allows them to process and deal with the trauma that's occurring, which is just so paradoxical and unfortunate.
And how many times we heard through writing The Price She Pays from people of like, oh yeah, he had sex with his athletes all the time. What? Like, I'm sorry, what? Like, you're just throwing that out there like it's common knowledge and acceptable and okay?
I think it's important for our listeners to know there's not a standard coach's like ethical rubric that says every coach anywhere has to abide by these ethical rules and principles. In some leagues and in some certifications, there's an expectation in terms of the training that says you're agreeing to not do these things. But in practice, what that translates to is a lot of different rules in a lot of different places, and gets really tricky when we start talking about young women who are adults, technically from thinking about them, they're no longer minors. They're 18 years of age and can, quote unquote, make decisions for themselves of relationships, even though we would probably say it's still exploitation. but it doesn't mean that it's banned in the sense of what the sport would say is happening. And some kind of collegiate coaches may have an expectation based on the institution that they're working with, considered as an employee with a student. You know, there's lots of layers of that potentially. But you all might have heard Katie and I talk about this before, where, you know, we have very strong ethical principles and expectations of us. So do a lot of careers and jobs, but that is definitely not one that exists in the world of coaching explicitly.
Mm-hmm. And therefore, there are no systems of accountability, which is why all these athletes have to flounder of where do I go and who do I tell? And is this okay or is it not okay? Right. Mm-hmm. And so oftentimes these gals are walking away of, I am the problem. I am responsible, when that's actually not the case. They mm-hmm. are not the one that is responsible. This was the coach's responsibility, and it was an abuse of power mm-hmm. in an abusive dynamic.
Yep. And I think the layer of this case that I think is true for so many young athletes on teams is they were saying, I didn't know that anything was wrong. I had no idea until recently, this is a quote, I had no idea until recently what grooming even meant or that he was grooming me. I didn't know anything was wrong. He gave many gifts. He actually gave a ring to one of the young women, gave them books, gave them stuffed animals, jewelry, mixtapes. And, you know, I think for a young girl, really is signifying these pretty classic, typical scripts within romantic relationships. And so without that education and without those rules and expectations and talking openly about what's needed, these are the kinds of things that are bound to happen because it sets up so much secrecy. And it's just, I wanted to bring it here just out of just pure frustration to see another case like this. And quite honestly, I wasn't even looking for anything for our recording. And I opened it up. I don't even know where I saw it. I opened up, I read it. And I was like, oh, that's typical. Like I was kind of like talking out loud and I was hearing myself going, oh, this is the kind of thing that we bring to the podcast. So this is happening in Pittsfield and a school called Miss Hall. So which is like Miss as in a young miss, or, you know, and Hall is typical. So Miss Hall is the name of the school. So if anyone's interested, they can follow the story and, you know, just sending lots of love to the incredible young women that are coming forward and sharing about this case, and to be continued. We'll see what happens.
Mm-hmm. I just keep hearing the gals we met with who just at the end of all conversations would say, just believe me. Just trust me.
Yeah. And I think, you know, when I think about this too, and definitely the women we interviewed for the book, the adults around them to take initiative to ask more questions and to notice that what's happening is wrong versus this waiting, that's what it kind of feels like, is a lot of the stories that you and I heard were, I mean, the second someone uttered a sentence of the story, you and I were, you know, that's not okay. And we know it's wrong. And we've been on the other end of a lot of those conversations of young athletes who have a story to tell. And I think in these cases, we wait for it to be so explicit and a disclosure to happen that is from start to finish makes sense that it's not okay. And that's where we do these young women and boys and you know, young people of all ages and identities and genders, and, you know, where they're exploited for, you know, the power of an adult. And I think the takeaway, if I can say, is I think the adults that are listening and are tuned in is pay attention. This is not the kind of thing that we share with this, like, this is, you know, one in a million. No, this is something that Katie and I hear, unfortunately, way too often, as Katie's nodding her head as I'm saying that. And the more that we can tune in, the more we can talk about the expectations between coaches and athletes and the adults that can have those conversations, and, you know, the the more that we can protect young athletes from predatory coaches. So what a great thing to talk about and just turn our attention to another topic. That's what we do here, I guess, is we're going to talk about the hard stuff. And that is one of the hard ones.
And it's the raising awareness, right? Of like, adults are missing it. And we need it to be like, you're running into a brick wall, that you're not going to miss it. It is our responsibility as adults to look out. These kids are in high school. If you're making comments or observations around him having special kids, that is a huge red flag. Intervene immediately. These are hard conversations, and wouldn't it be lovely if we could get to a time when it can just be about sport and not the harm that's being caused to people? That would be a dream come true, and an example that we have systems in place that are protecting athletes' mental health. Like, that is what we all strive for. So,
yeah. It's disappointing that the conversations have to happen. And I love what you just said. We absolutely have to have them. So if you're listening and you're going, oh my gosh, way to bring on the big stuff. Yes, that is what we're going to do here every now and again. And part of it is to raise awareness. And the other part of it is because this is the kind of stuff that's happening. And part of the awareness is to talk about it to the point where we're not missing it, like you're saying, in our day to day. And we're recognizing that if it's possible for one gal, it's possible for a lot of others, and we can play a really significant role. And like you said, to believe them, and it's nuanced and it's difficult when, you know, we don't catch on to it right away and we feel really guilty about that, but, the sooner the better. And when we do, that's the important moment. So what's hard left turn into, actually, we're gonna talk about more coaches is what I'm understanding, right? Do you want to tell us about our caller today?
Yeah, this weaves well with the episode, but we got a submission from Ben, who asked a question about abusive coaching and shared some of his experience as an athlete and wondering, where are the bounds? So we'll play that question for you and then peel it back.
Hey guys, Ben from Oregon here. I'm wondering what to do with some of these quote unquote old school coaching tactics that I actually responded to really well when I was an athlete. Some of the screaming, yelling, even a little bit of physicality. Can these things still exist in our new world that I believe is actually healthier when it comes to our approach and coaching? Or should those things go away altogether? Thanks.
Oh my gosh, Ben. So I love the question. I have so many thoughts. I think that's what the complexity is. Like, that is complexity. It's nuanced, and there's so many, it's a spectrum, right? And so we like to think about it. I'm going to summarize a little bit here, but think about it within the bell curve, right? So we want to be really clear before we jump into any conversation about abuse in terms of safety, especially we're coming off of this other conversation. It's really important to name that there's this gray area, sure, but there's also these outliers that are never okay. These sexual dynamics, grooming, abusive dynamics, we are never going to condone ever. So we're going to be talking within this bell curve, looking at abuse. And Tiffany, I mean, I have so many thoughts. I have so many opinions, but Tiffany, you listening to his question, you popped into my head first thing, because you have made statements of absolutely no yelling. Yelling falls in one of those things that you think is outside, or the way you've talked about it historically, let's talk about it here, but is that it falls outside of that bell curve. Let's start there. And then we'll peel back every piece of his question, because it's a good one.
Yeah, it's a really good one. And I think especially knowing that there are some old school coaching tactics that are out in the world, and some of them still work really well and some of them do not. So my perspective of yelling is knowing that there's a difference in having a coach, or a parent for that matter, but we're talking about coaches today. A coach who feels strongly about something and is communicating to their athlete with a loud voice, that type of yelling is to me something that is permissible. The yelling that comes from, you did something wrong and I'm going to shame you right now, and how I'm going to do that is with a raised voice, that always feels outside of the bounds for me. And even when I'm watching coaches, and don't get me wrong, I love intensity in coaches. I want to see their passion. I want to see their commitment. I want to see them, like, you know, in it with, you know, their athletes at every turn. And when I watch them yelling to the degree that it's at the players, not with them, that's where I start to, my feathers get a little ruffled, and I start to wonder about the health of that relationship and what's going on with that coach. There's definitely exceptions to that, but I've seen more times than I can count the coach who's yelling and has a shaming message that's attached to it. So that's usually why I have that kind of almost like to be more conservative in the position. Knowing that I almost want someone to hear me say that, I guess maybe this is like behind the curtain. I want someone to hear like no yelling and catch themselves and go, oh God, I kind of yell. Should I not yell? And think about it for a minute. At the same time, I don't want to hear what you think, Katie. At the same time, I mean, back when I was a coach, there's some days where you have to yell across a very loud basketball court to get your kid to hear you of what play you're actually calling, given how close the game is or whatever. So that to me is a very different thing. A kid coming off the court or coming off the field and standing right there, waiting to go sit down on the bench and being kind of that, the type of yelling that comes with the finger pointing, that's what I usually have a very strong position about. But I don't know. What do you think?
Oh, I mean, the distinguisher of shame's a big one, right? Like, shame would fall outside of the bell curve. So anything that's shame-based, outside of the bell curve. But when you said this, like the animated coaching, there's the, I mean, anybody who has talked to me for like 5 seconds, I will rave about Camden's baseball program that he's a part of right now, because it's like bar none. And at the parent intro night, one of the director of the league said, I used to coach and I got great pride when people would call me the Tiger, because I was just in it and I was like animated and engaged and big. And he said, and then I realized like the game time isn't the time for that. That would be the practice time. Game time, it's like we need to be as regulated as possible. And I loved that. So now anytime, and there was one of the teams Camden played over the weekend, the coach was animated on the sideline. He got a little shamey in terms of even kind of how he was talking to like Camden's coach and things of that nature, of just like, it was a little but he was animated. And I found it to be so off-putting, because I was like, dude, chill. Like right now is not your time to just think you're going to like embody something in them. It's like, you need to be regulated so the players can stay regulated. They are using you as one of their cues. So I think it's such a fine line of like, my opinion of yelling is more in competition is a time to be regulated, because the athletes, you aren't going to teach them a new skill in competition. They're going to learn that by engaging in the competition. However, to Ben's question of like, I do think there's something about the sharedness of athletics that can give a heightened experience, right? It's, we say this all the time. This is why we love sport, because it elicits emotion. And so I think about the yelling or this animated engagement, it has to come from a place of attunement and rapport. So different athletes are going to need different things, but how does the athlete feel if you're in their face and you're like, that was fantastic, or I need more from you, I need you to show up and I need you to toe the line in a different way? If you have a established relationship where the athlete trusts you and that is a relationship builder, great. But if you don't have a rapport with the athlete and that is going to be scary to the athlete, then it is not okay. And I think the biggest thing for me when I think about this question is, it isn't for any of us to decide externally. It's to, what do the people in the dynamic feel? Does it work for them or not? Because different things do work for different people, and different philosophies work for different people. There might be an amazing coach that works really well for one athlete and not for the other athlete. And those are the important nuanced pieces of this that are so important. Outside of the bell curve, never okay. But if we're working within this gray zone, it has to be about, how does it feel for you as an athlete? What is the relationship like with your coach? Is there attunement happening that your needs are getting met in the way that work for you?
Mm-hmm.
in my opinion.
I totally agree. I think it's that indicator, and I see it. I maybe think about it that, but from a different vantage point of, so you're naming kind of what it feels like in the dynamic and having that relationship with the coach as a player or as an athlete. I also think about it from the realm of what are the other tools that the coach has in their toolbox? If the only way that they know how to coach is to scream and yell, they're not a good coach. Like, I really believe that. Yeah. And I've watched coaches not know how to pull a player off the court or the field and teach them, right? To say, hey, this is why that happened. You know, you were not in the right position or whatever the moment is, to tinker with the skill or the play calling. But if they do something wrong and the only way that the coach knows how to respond is to yell at them. And again, even if it's not shaming, even if it's like, that's not what we do, and that way I need more from you. But if that's the only tool in their toolbox, I know a lot of athletes that would say, that's just how coach is. And there's this like acceptance. And I think that's a little bit about what Ben's saying around, you know, he's like, where's the line around this kind of old school coaching? Because I think it's a little bit of an old school tactic. And I don't know if this is the nice way to put it, but I think it can be super lazy, super lazy. Like, if I yell, then I'm being the coach. I'm being active. I'm in it. Versus maybe I need to slow down, like you're saying, and be regulated. I need to notice that I'm all up in arms, which I don't think I've ever watched a game and haven't seen a coach dysregulated at some point. I do not believe that a coach is going to be on the sidelines and be regulated 100% of a game or match. It's the capacity to notice that uptick and like, and to adjust and notice the uptick and adjust. But what I notice sometimes with coaches is the laziness to me is they're not teaching. They're not doing skill development. They're not correcting. They're not thinking about how we have so much research that says just yelling at a bunch of people does not get them to do anything faster, stronger, better. And I don't think it makes, if that's the only tool in their toolbox, I don't think it makes them a great coach. There might be a handful of players on that team that they have a relationship with that they're able to do that. But I think they have to, it would be really hard for me to accept that every single player on a team, that's the tactic that works for them.
Oh, totally.
Does that make sense? Like,
yeah, I hear that. And I mean, I think this has been the most humbling part of parenting for me, that I don't want to pretend to be a coach, but I do think it translates, is oftentimes if things are vibrating high or there's a hum in my house and I'm like, oh my gosh, my kids are out of control, right? To summarize, my kids are out of control. And I can take the moment to pause. Do you want to know who's actually out of control? Me. Uh-huh. This actually doesn't have anything to do with my kids. This has to do that I am dysregulated and therefore the system is dysregulated. So there is a coach by nature is a leader, right? Uh-huh. So they are constantly teaching games. Of course, they're going to teach, but that's not a time to project, right? To say like, you're out of line. Why'd you miss the rebound? Of course, the kid didn't want to miss the rebound. Duh. They know that, right? They're already heightened. Mm-hmm. They're nervous. Everything is on edge. So that's a great conversation to come back around to, right? So as a coach, sure, you might be really frustrated that kid just missed the rebound. However, it is your responsibility. If you want your athletes to be able to perform their best, you have to get out of their head. And the parents or coaches, I believe this, of like, if you are in the athlete's head, the athlete's performance will falter. So the best way to stay out of their head is to have this element of being regulated, whatever that's going to mean, right? Uh-huh. Of not to say you aren't going to have fluctuations within your nervous system, but how are you conveying that? And somebody might need a really hard, like, I believe in you. You have got to believe in yourself. And that is intense. That maybe wasn't yelling, but it was certainly an aggressive tone, right? Mm-hmm. But it might not be effective for another person who would prefer feedback in a different way. Mm-hmm. And so I think what I like about Ben's question is also, this is a little bit what we're running into in general in sport, of this like penduluming, right? Of like, okay, before it was this old school coaching, yell, get in their face, maybe give them a little shake. And now we're like, okay, never touch an athlete, never yell at an athlete. Parents can absolutely never talk to the coach. And it's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Where's the middle ground, right? Like, how can we add intention behind how we're coaches are coaching instead of just saying like, everything's a hard no always. Never can you do these things. It's like, no, sometimes it is appropriate, right? And sometimes the athlete is out of line or they've broken a code of conduct or they have had an extremely negative impact on their teammates. Mm-hmm. That deserves a harsher engagement. Does it mean shaming? Absolutely not. But does it mean, you know what? No, here's the line and you crossed it. Yeah. And there are consequences for that. And this is going to be an assertive conversation.
I think that I like that framing too of how, like, what's that middle ground? Because I think if we only define good coaching from wins and losses, we miss everything we need to be talking about, which is, you know, you and I feel strongly about that. It's why we wrote the book we wrote. At the same time, I think there's so much to be said for the level of deepening relationships with your players. And I think that at times, even if we don't know what was happening on the inside of a team, I think some of the old school coaching that maybe we were observing where we were seeing that intensity and that yelling and that, you know, animation likely could have been because they had really meaningful relationships with their athletes. Sometimes outsider looking in, we don't see that. But I look at some of these coaches and I struggle sometimes to be able to even name them as a good coach. And I know we've had this conversation before where it's like, we're always hesitant because we know that there's some story that could come out that would tell us something totally different. But I look at the women's basketball tournament for NCAA and those, you know, Dawn Staley had just an incredible relationship on the surface, what we observed, with her athletes. And, you know, her other, we've talked about kind of that signifier of a meaningful coach and, you know, these other players coming back and visiting and talking and cheering them on and wanting it for their coach as much as they want it for the other parts of the team. And, you know, is Dawn Staley intense? Yeah. I've watched, you know, some games where she is intense and she's, you know, she's upset about a play call or she's upset about someone took a shot they shouldn't have taken and they missed, you know? But I think it's about that level of relationship so that a coach then knows the range of options that are necessary. And it makes me really think if I have any of my students listening to this episode, they're going to probably roll their eyes that I'm going to get into theory right now, but a lot when we're working with families about how they're stuck in redundant behaviors. They're stuck in those patterns of like, it's all they know to do. And they come to family therapy and we say, we got to get out of the stuckness and we have to expand the range of possibilities so you can get better results as a system. And I think it's the same thing for a team. When I watch a coach be upset that they're not doing better as a team, and I think that they, you know, I watch them blame the players or I watch them blame, you know, something totally out of their control. My first thought is look at yourself, look at what you're doing as a coach and your tactics may not be working. Your tactics may need to be different. And that's the thing. I like what Ben's saying about, you know, where do we fall back on some of that? And where do we kind of move forward? Because I think the moving forward is a really good look at self and the honesty that comes with saying, whoa, I'm only using a small range of behaviors within my repertoire of coaching. And if I want to stay in this job, if I want to stay committed to the athletes that I'm working with, then I need to get out of my own way. And I need to do some things a little bit differently. And sometimes it means shaking it up to the degree of getting out of your own comfort zone. And I think a lot of coaches have a lot of pride and it's really difficult for them to look outside of themselves and acknowledge that maybe they need to do something a little bit different.
And I think asking that question, I think if coaches could ask that question of athletes of how do you feel my support? If the coach sincerely believes in the athlete, how can the coach convey that to the athlete and show the athlete? If I am noticing a dip in your motivation, how can I help inspire you to reach your potential that I know you're capable of? And somebody might be like, get in my face and remind me. I believe in you. I want you to show up. Others might say, you know what? I need you to write it down so I can post it on my, put the post-it on my mirror and read it every morning. Great. Okay. We have to be adaptable. There are, and it requires the athlete to know, what do I need? Right. So a coach asking the athlete that question, if the athlete can't answer the question, there's no way the coach would know how to support them, right? Or how they're going to inspire them. But so then everybody has a level of responsibility. Yeah. Jump in.
Okay. Here's the other thing though. I don't know what you would say about this, but I think the other part of that is we have talked a lot about the athlete knowing what they need. And I believe that to my core, like that is part of, you know, part of what we're hoping to help athletes figure out, what we'd like parents to join us in to help athletes know what they need and for athletes to work on that themselves. All that to say, there are coaches who are working with kids that are at ages that their capacity to do that introspection is so minimal, and not because they're not capable, but because emotionally of their development, socially their development, the power difference when you're in middle school or high school and have a coach who's also your teacher, you know, all the layers that are attached to that. And I'm thinking specifically about something I observed this last year, and I watched a player on a team go through a really, really hard time. And granted, I knew the inside information. I knew what they were going through. But I watched their temperament in games was different. My best guess is that showed up in practice. And actually, they told me that it showed up in practice. And the coach never once paused and said, "Whoa, how are you doing?" And instead doubled down on their yelling, doubled down on their shaming, doubled down thinking like, well, it's what I've done. I better do it extra now to try to get them out of this rut. And I really strongly, strongly believe that if the coach would have gone to the player and said, "Hey, I'm noticing things are a little bit different. I don't have to know what's going on if you don't want to tell me. But how can I support you? What do you need?" And even asking of the question, I think would have taken the intensity out of the dynamic that was happening between them, because the athlete was being relied upon to do everything for this team and was struggling, but there was no room for mistakes and there was no room to have a hard time. And so I think sometimes the coaching starts to shift or doesn't, sorry, the coaching doesn't shift when it needs to. And I know we were just talking about like being nimble in that way and shifting as needed. But I think it also misses sometimes developmentally what is possible for a group of kids.
I think, I mean, and maybe that's going to be our next project, is creating what is age appropriate. If we create kind of this timeline of youth development in sport, I think for regulated coaches for youth sports is necessary, right? Because the kids literally don't have the frontal brain development to be able to ask some of these questions. So you have to have really clear boundaries and expectation and be the leader in that capacity. As people get older, later in high school, college, more professional, that can become more conversational. Mm-hmm. But yeah, a 9-year-old isn't going to be able to answer, "How do I support you?" Right? Of like, "Do you like when I yell at you, or do you like when I write you a note?" Like a 12-year-old likely won't be able to answer that question, right?
Totally.
So we do have to have some parameters. There has to be, even if a coach like looped, if you lose your cool and you lose like orientation to your North Star, coming back and repairing is always a critical piece, or checking in of like Ben's coach. I would be curious if they said, "Hey, I got in your face. I jostled you a little bit. How you doing? How'd that feel?" And he's like, "That pumped me up. I feel psyched. I'm ready to go hit the field." And it's like, yeah, okay, cool. We're good then. That's the attunement piece, right? Mm-hmm. Or if the kid is kind of like wide-eyed and it was okay, coach. And it's like, okay, clearly it wasn't okay. So then we need to really focus on the rapport, right? Because the attunement piece is so critical that the kids need was met, and they're not just saying it was because you are the person who is in power. It's variable. And I think it is what adds so much complexity to the coach's role is, one, they don't have a board of ethics, right? So they don't have any type of even agreement in terms of what they can and cannot do. And it's like the Wild West. I mean, it's a whole spectrum of how people engage.
And there's such a need for coaches that they get to be the wild, wild west and get to behave badly because they need to fill those spots with those coaches.
Yeah, the like coaching crisis.
Like, it's not like there's a million of them lining up, totally, you know, saying like, you know, put me in to coach the next generation, which, yeah, there's a whole episode in and of itself that we should. Yeah. Okay. Well, we gotta wrap this one up, but any final thoughts on that before we do?
No, thank you for the question. Our debrief of it probably punctuates how nuanced it really is. And the gray zone is the gray zone, and attunement is the most important takeaway of making sure if you're a coach that what your philosophy is and how your coaching is landing with your athletes and building them up to believe in themselves more. Mm-hmm. That's the goal.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I would say, if you hear someone like us saying, don't yell, and you bristle at that, then I would say just pause for a second and ask yourself, do you have other tools in the toolbox? Because if it sounds like someone's taking away your number one tool, you might need some other tools. I would love to wrestle with that conversation even further. So I'm glad you brought it up. And thanks for Ben. And, you know, this is a chance for us to plug our book. We're going to say really quickly, we have a book coming out in June. It is called The Price She Pays. We would love for you to pre-order that. It means a lot to us if you do. You can also find us on our website at athletesmentalhealthfoundation.org, or check us out on Instagram, where we're actually giving some previews of the new book and have a lot going on there. And our Instagram handle is Athletes Mental Health Foundation. And thanks again for listening to Sports Drinks, and we'll be back soon. Thank you so much.
Thank you.